Welcome to Lethal Autonomous Weapons, 10 Things We Want to Know. This is Episode 7, How Could an International Treaty Regulate Autonomous Weapons? You're listening to an interview with Richard Moyes, hosted by Paola Gaeta and Alessandra Spadoro.
Thank you, Ryan, and hello, everyone. I'm Paola Gaeta, and I'm Professor of International Law at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies, where I lead a research project on lethal autonomous weapons and war crimes.
And I'm Alessandra Spadaro. I'm a research associate in Paola's project.
Well, in this episode, we talk about the possibility that states might adopt a new treaty regulating autonomous weapons in the future. Our guest today is Richard Moyes, the managing director of Article 36, which is a non-profit organization which focuses on reducing harm from weapons and actively working, among other things, for the adoption of new legal standards on emerging technologies. So welcome, Richard, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Paola. Hi, Alessandra. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Thank you, Richard. So our listeners probably know that for a few years now, states have been discussing autonomous weapons in the framework of the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, that is known as the CCW. They did so first in a series of informal meetings, and then they created a group of governmental experts on autonomous weapons. So my question is, why was the CCW chosen as the framework to discuss regulating potentially autonomous weapons? And do you think that this is the right forum for these discussions?
Yeah, thanks, Alessandra. Well, the CCW, the Convention on Conventional Weapons, is a United Nations sort of treaty body. It provides a standing structure under which states meet quite regularly, and under which they can start to discuss new issues, new subject matter. So in a way, the CCW is something of an obvious choice for this issue, because it's a ready-made framework for talking about weapon technology related issues. That said, the CCW has its pros and cons. The proponents of the CCW would say this is a treaty that has all the big players on board, which basically means it has many of the major militarized states are part of it. On the other hand, it has a mode of work by an interpretation of consensus that means that pretty much any state can block progress if they choose to. And that makes it a little bit awkward to achieve actual outcomes. So in some ways, it's the obvious choice, but it has its challenges.
One of the milestones in the discussion within the CCW framework has been the adoption quite recently of a set of guiding principles on lethal autonomous weapons. And this was done in 2019. So could you tell us more about these guiding principles on lethal autonomous weapons? Are they legally binding? What is their role in the negotiation process for a treaty?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say I'm a little bit skeptical of the guiding principles. I mean, they started off as guiding principles that were intended to guide the work of the group. So they were there to guide how states talk to each other about the issue of autonomous weapons and to help to move the conversation in a certain direction. After a certain point, they became rather more like an end in themselves, as states started to orientate to these guiding principles as if they were the actual outcome of the work that they were supposed to be guiding. I think this is part of a familiar political dynamic, really, within the CCW, which is states seeking outcomes that they can try to, I guess, sell as being a satisfactory response to a subject matter without actually going too far. So no, they're not legally binding. Some states have also adopted these guiding principles as a political declaration in a separate framework. So there's been another attempt to turn them into an output after they were adopted in the CCW. They provide some useful points of guidance for the conversation, but frankly, they don't really provide a clear structure for the subject matter. And I don't think you could really mistake them for a genuine, substantive policy legal response to the issues at hand in this space.
Well, but nonetheless, Richard, even though you are quite skeptical about their importance, and I might agree with you, I mean, nonetheless, if you should pick, no, the most important guiding principle, which one would you pick? And what is the most unsatisfactory principle, according to you?
I don't know if I've got them. I mean, to be honest, I don't pay too much attention to them. We, within Article 36, have written a detailed commentary on them, so I have paid some attention to them, but it's not like I've memorized them, because I don't think they're that significant to the conversation, frankly. The most important one, it would be, I think it's guiding principle C, insofar as it points to the need for a certain degree of human engagement in the use of force. Probably the least impressive to my mind is whichever one it is towards the end that asserts that the CCW is an appropriate forum for discussing the matter. If you start adopting guiding principles in which you're saying about yourself that you're the appropriate forum to deal with issues, I think you've got to wonder about your insecurity issues, frankly.
So, Richard, so far states, including within the group of governmental experts, have only been talking about autonomous weapons and international humanitarian law. Although, of course, autonomous weapons might be used outside armed conflict scenarios when international humanitarian law does not apply. And we already asked this to our guest in episode 5, Andrea Spagnolo, but we would really be curious to hear your opinion on this. Why do you think that states have been focusing on international humanitarian law and have left out human rights law from their discussions on autonomous weapons?
Well, I think it's because the conversation is dominated by the more militarized states, and humanitarian law allows you to kill people more easily than human rights law does, right? I mean, that's basically the reason why. And I think this then comes back to a more systemic issue within the CCW framework, that the CCW has a tendency to push issues towards the IHL framing rather than a human rights law framing. This reflects the origins of the CCW, and in many ways its preamble and its own textual orientations as coming out in the 1970s of discussions in which the additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions were being adopted. So the CCW as an instrument has an IHL-ish tendency. Obviously, that's politically convenient in this context, but it shouldn't, I don't think, actually limit the proper treatment of the subject matter, because, of course, the role of machines in making determinations about where and when force is applied, that can have implications within armed conflict, and it could have implications in situations that are not armed conflict situations. And certainly there are important human rights related issues implicated in this subject matter. I mean, the issue of human dignity is, I think, a fundamental point in all of this. So it's one of the shortcomings of the CCW framework, and it was an issue in the guiding principles. It's an issue in the conversation still right now being October 2021, when states are still discussing within the GGE. That's a group of governmental experts that is discussing this issue of autonomous weapon systems, what they're going to report for the end of this year, and whether or not human rights law considerations get included in that is still a contentious issue.
Well, I guess that perhaps your organization, in advancing some proposals for the regulations of lethal autonomous weapons, in a way takes more into account human rights law, since you suggest, for instance, that lethal autonomous weapons that would target humans and the lethal autonomous weapon systems which do not allow for meaningful human control should be prohibited. I guess that this is because of human rights law perspective. But can you tell us more about this? So why do you suggest that these systems should be prohibited?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think particularly when we talk about a prohibition on systems targeting people, that's the case. Our overall policy response is to suggest certain systems prohibited, other systems need to be subject to certain regulations. As you suggested, specific prohibitions on systems that would target people or systems that can't be sufficiently controlled, can't be used with meaningful human control in our language. When we talk about the idea of systems targeting people, I think that's where we can draw quite a bright normative line against this category of weapons. And for us, this prohibition, it doesn't flow straightforwardly from existing IHL concerns, but actually it's really responding to perhaps a more fundamental set of moral and ethical anxieties about the idea of machines somehow processing people, and on the basis of that processing, subjecting them to an application of force. effectively means machines making decisions about killing or harming people. I think we see in that process of sensors identifying human beings as targets a process of dehumanization, because machines, after all, can't recognize people as people. They just see a pattern of sensor data. So there's a dehumanization there that is really tied to issues of human dignity, which is a bit closer to a human rights law perspective than an IHL perspective. So we don't see that prohibition as flowing straightforwardly from the requirements of existing law, but as being a necessary legal response to a moral and ethical hazard that would come from enabling this idea of machines identifying people and selecting people to be subject to force.
Excellent. Excellent. I wanted to follow up and saying that Professor Sassoli and other colleagues have said that indeed IHL does not require that death or life decision shall be taken by a human being under IHL. So,
but I think that's why it's an argument for the need for new rules, right? I mean, if we were only saying what IHL already says, then you don't need to have new rules. And I know some lawyers think that the law was perfected in the late 1970s or something, but that's just not really how society works. So,
in this respect, what's the difference between embedding, let's say, embedding within a weapon system an algorithm that would allow the machine itself to target a human being, and the current situation where decisions in targeting are based on algorithms and data processed by algorithms? So what is it really a difference that we will face going a step forward? May I ask you, what's your view?
I mean, I think when we talk about machines targeting people, we're talking about sort of anti-personnel systems or systems that are targeting people as people. So it's not about human beings being harmed as a result of the weapon system functioning, but it's about the process of a person being identified by a machine. But we know that machines don't see people as people. They're just identifying a pattern of data that is a representation of people. So it's a reduction in that identification of a pattern of data. It's a reduction of somebody's humanity into essentially an object. It's a sort of objectification process. If we expand our sort of remit and think, well, we're not just talking about this automated process of sensors identify people, force is applied automatically as a result. If we think, well, we've got sensors identifying people as targets and we've got a human being pressing a button to apply force to that person without actually engaging with the meaning of it, I think that's also a problem, right? I think that is also a moral problem. The question perhaps is a more pragmatic and political one here, that it's difficult to make progress in controlling weapons and applying laws and policies to weapons. And it requires you to divide up the subject matter into bite-sized chunks, would be the sort of idiom in British, but into pieces that you can deal with in some sort of manageable way. And I feel that with that sort of question that you've raised there, yes, there are issues in that space. And I think, but by keeping this focus on automated weapon systems, we don't need to say that's not a problem. We just need to say, this is what we're dealing with here. And we should be mindful when we're dealing with this, that we're not adopting principles that, that allow something or enable something over there, because there's also issues in that space. So I don't think the two things need to be set against each other in a problematic way. Rather, I think we can recognize concerns in both spaces, but for now, we have enough on our plate, to continue my food-based metaphor structure here. We have enough on our plate to deal with just on the autonomous weapon systems, without getting into the wider questions of AI and targeting more broadly.
So, Richard, going back to the proposals that have been advanced by your organization, Article 36, concerning potentially how to regulate autonomous weapons, I would like to discuss your proposal to subject configurations of weapons that would be not prohibited to certain obligations concerning their development and their use, so that they can be used in accordance with existing legal obligations under humanitarian law. Can you give us a couple of examples of what obligations you were envisioning when advancing this proposal?
Yeah, so I think our sense is that whilst we would like to draw some clear lines rejecting systems that target people or rejecting systems that can't be used with control, developments of technology in these areas, developments in sensor technologies or in processing technologies, they're enabling an expansion of machine weapon system use over longer periods of time and over potentially wider areas within that envelope, with machines making decisions about, you know, where and when specifically force is being applied. So in this space, we feel that there's a need to adopt certain rules that can sort of pull back against that tendency to expansion and try to ensure that humans who are the subjects of the law and humans who have the obligations to apply the law, to try to ensure that people can still apply existing legal rules appropriately when they use weapon systems. And essentially, I think there's a few key areas here. Fundamental is understanding the system that you're using. If you don't understand the system that you're using, then you can't make sufficient predictions about what it's going to do. So there's understanding your own technology, but then there's a question of understanding the context within which that technology is going to be put into operation. And I think for us, the question of the duration of system functioning and the question of the area of system functioning, both of these factors of duration and spatial area, they both bear upon the understanding of context and the complexity of context and the ability for a human user of weapons to be able to evaluate that context and make meaningful judgments about it. So understandability of the systems, understanding what will trigger an application of force by them, and controlling the space and the duration of weapon use. I think these are all basically critical to making sure that the existing legal rules that apply in an attack, that they're still being applied in a meaningful way. Because otherwise, if we allow these to expand and expand, then this notion of an attack, which is, it's sort of a military notion, but it's also a legal notion. It's a legal notion that ties human engagement into the legal fabric. If we allow that to just expand and expand, then essentially we're seeing a dilution of human moral agency in the application of the law. And we need to work against that. We need to keep putting our trust in people as legal agents and push for more human engagement and more legal application.
Right. And if I may ask for a clarification, when you speak of individuals and people who need to understand these weapons, who are you talking about exactly? Is it commanders who order an attack? Is it the people actively deploying the weapon? Who is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is tied to issues of accountability and responsibility, that if you are ordering the use of a system or you're using a system and you're going to be responsible for that use, then you need to have a sufficient understanding of the system that you're using for that responsibility to bear appropriately upon you. So, I mean, I think there's going to be requirements for understanding perhaps throughout the chain of a weapon systems development to the point of use, but certainly the users of systems need to have an appropriate understanding of how that system functions and therefore what it's likely to do in certain circumstances. I would say, at a baseline, they need to understand what are the external conditions that will trigger an application of force from this system, because you need to know, if you want to target armored fighting vehicles, will this system strike only armored fighting vehicles, or will it strike civilian trucks, civilian cars? What are the other things that may trigger an application of force, a sort of false positives, as it were? So I think I would say that like an appropriate understanding. I mean, we don't expect people to perhaps understand every single line of code that's within a complicated system. And I think we already navigate this quite regularly in the modern world, where we all use technology that we don't fully understand its internal workings, but we hope we have a sufficient understanding of it to do the job we need to do and to take responsibility for using it in certain circumstances. So I think the legal test would be in that kind of space of an appropriate understanding.
Well, let's hope that states will be listening to your proposals, Article 36 proposals. In this respect, I would like to ask you whether or not you are optimistic about the adoption of a treaty regulating or eventually prohibiting lethal autonomous weapons systems?
Well, I'm paid to be optimistic, Paola. So yes. No, I am optimistic, of course. Not at the end of this year, you know, not at the CCW review conference that's coming up in December. But I think if one takes a broader view of where this issue is, then I think there's, you know, there's every grounds for optimism. I mean, just within the last year, frankly, we've seen a substantial movement towards a coherent policy orientation in this area. I mean, the broad lines that I'm suggesting here, or that, you know, we're attributing to Article 36 in this conversation, frankly, there's a substantial number of states who are taking the same basic orientation to the subject matter. There are other international organizations. I would see the ICRC's orientation to this subject as being within the same broad structure. And I think really this year, for the first time, we're starting to have a much more straightforward, coherent conversation. People are agreeing with each other, and at least now they're also understanding where they don't fully agree with each other yet. So I think this is a very significant development. I mean, the most significant development, that you can have a productive conversation now. And if you were to put on the table next year a text as the starting point for negotiations of a legal treaty, you could put on the table a text that a large number of states in the room would be able to, they'd be able to see where it came from, and they'd be able to situate it within the debate. And even if they didn't agree with all of it, they would know basically what their policy orientation to that is. So this kind of coherence is a necessary foundation for the development of a legal instrument. Of course, it's not a sufficient step in itself, but it's a necessary foundation. I think we will need to get through the review conference at the end of the year. We'll see where that ends up. I've been working within the CCW in different roles for quite a long period of time, since the mid-2000s. I would broadly expect, I'm afraid, that it's going to struggle to move to negotiations of a protocol. It's going to struggle to agree that mandate. That's what it should agree, but I think it'll struggle to agree that. There's a group of states who will want to try to convince us, civil society, convince themselves, convince others that progress is being made towards some sort of meaningful outcome. I guess we're going to have to see how convincing those claims are. And if they're not sufficiently convincing, then I feel like within our society as a whole, we will find other ways forward towards the development of a legal instrument.
Because I guess that the risk is that, as you mentioned, given the fact that within the CCW, there are many military powers which have an interest in developing these lethal autonomous weapon systems, I guess that there is the risk that if a regulation is adopted, then it will be perhaps loose or not very straightforward in terms of what is allowed and what is prohibited. This is my fear. What do you think?
I think that's a plausible perspective. I mean, I think there will be an energy from some, perhaps, to try to get adopted within the CCW a political outcome, not a legal outcome, and a political outcome that purports to be a solution, but actually does not draw any lines that actually constrain any kind of military practice. Perhaps it will prohibit fully autonomous weapons where fully autonomous weapons are described in a way that makes them rather a fantastical, you know, creation that is designed by machines to operate without, you know, any kind of human engagement and control whatsoever. I mean, these kind of notions of the completely uncontrolled and uncontrollable system. I mean, if you turn a system on, you're controlling it to some degree. I mean, there's a sort of fantasy land orientation in some of this. And I think this is partly an effort to try to draw a line under the issue and then to close it off. I just don't think that's going to work, frankly. I mean, these issues are genuinely quite serious for society, right? I mean, sometimes I feel that state conversations talk about this stuff, you know, as if it's just a subject matter that happens to be on the table of the CCW. But actually, the extent to which we have machines making decisions about human lives is a very significant issue for how we're going to relate to technology across all areas of society in the future. And drawing sensible lines in this space is something we should expect of international diplomatic fora. It shouldn't be a luxury. It should be an expectation that we solve problems like this. So I think once these CCW conversations have moved through another phase or so, perhaps, we're going to need to see like a serious social response to the matter.
Right, Richard, but then forgive me for insisting that you reflect maybe on a more pessimistic outcome. If a treaty is not adopted, then what happens? Because we know, of course, that under Article 36 of the first additional protocol to the Geneva Conventions, which I assume is where your organization takes the name from, states have to conduct weapons reviews whenever they want to develop or use new weapons to make sure that they can comply with international humanitarian law. And so if we do not have a treaty on autonomous weapons, do you think that weapon reviews would be sufficient to prevent states from developing and using fully autonomous weapons that might target humans and might not be subjected to meaningful human control?
No, I don't think it'll be sufficient. I mean, that's why we need a legal instrument. And I mean, weapon reviews under Article 36 are straightforwardly supposed to be reviews against the existing legal framework. So those review processes have an important role to play in the future, but they should be reviewing new technologies against a new legal instrument that provides the clear, specific rules needed to constrain autonomy in this space. So no, the kind of rules that I think we see as necessary in this space, they need to be articulated on their own terms. So no, that wouldn't be sufficient. I guess more of a question in political terms is how does a process to develop a new legal instrument actually get initiated? And I think that's where we will need to turn our attention next year, particularly.
Well, turn your attention to me for a second. I'm here to remind you it's time to start wrapping up.
Well, this is our friendly non-lethal robot, Private Ryan. And I guess that, Ryan, you wanted to ask your usual final question to our guests.
Yes, please.
So please go ahead.
Richard, what are three adjectives that come to mind when you think of lethal autonomous weapon systems?
I can't believe you're forcing me to work out what an adjective is at this time of day.
Yep, sorry about that.
I would say cold. Could cold be an adjective in this context? These are all the same thing, I think. Cold, heartless, non-feeling.
Wow, you describe robots indeed. Very good.
I will try hard not to feel offended.
Is that what I was supposed to be describing?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Right. I mean, some people have receiving the same question, they have really expanded with full sentences. So very good understanding of what adjective means.
I was just trying to follow the rules like a robot would. I'm just trying to blend in.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I think that we really have to wrap up. And then thank you again for coming on our podcast, Richard. And listeners, please tune in for our next episodes where we will continue our conversations on lethal autonomous weapons, the 10 things we wanted to know.
And please do get in touch with us with your comments and suggestions. You can tweet us at laws_warcrimes or email us at laws.warcrimes@graduateinstitute.ch.
Thank you for tuning into episode 7 of Lethal Autonomous Weapons, 10 Things We Want to Know, with Richard Moyes. All papers mentioned in this episode are linked in the show notes. There you will also find our contact details and a link to our website, where you will find more episodes and read more about our lethal autonomous weapons and war crimes research project. Thank you for listening. Catch you in the next episode, where we will cover the question, can humans exercise meaningful control over lethal autonomous weapons? Over and out.